Good to be back with you this evening. We're going to be continuing a small study that on 2 Thessalonians 2 that we had started 2 weeks ago, that we had singing night, and we'll probably have another lesson on this, but it won't be for another 3 weeks or so. So you have to really remember what we talked about. but 2 Thessalonians 2, a really terrifying text about this horrible man of lawlessness, this son of perdition, this blasphemous man who exalts himself even above God. And Paul is writing to the Thessalonians saying, telling them, hold on here, you know, you don't need to be too worried right now about the coming of the Lord, he said, because his coming will not happen until the man of lawlessness appears. That's something I think that's concerning for us, because if he's talking about the final day of judgment, then that means this man of lawlessness can show up, you know, at any second. Or maybe he's already here, and that doesn't sound good at all. But what we were looking at is context. Isn't that what we always look at, right? It's all about the context. And even in the New Testament, the discussion about the coming of the Lord does not necessarily refer to the final day of judgment. But in fact, I think more often than not even, if we were to go through and count all the times of discussions about the coming of the Lord, probably the greater percentage, a little bit of the greater percentage anyway, is actually dealing with something that was much more personal to that generation of people. That being the Lord's coming against the physical kingdom of Israel in the first century. Okay, the fall of Judea, the fall of Jerusalem, the fall of the temple, the fall of that whole priesthood, that whole old covenant system coming crumbling down by the power of the new covenant, Christ. And so that's how the New Testament refers to that situation that happened in the first century when the Romans came up against Jerusalem. It is referred to, even Jesus himself refers to it as his coming. And we saw that in our discussion of the Olivet Discourse, last month or so, Matthew 24 and the lessons we had on that. So I'll put up here a chart that I used last time, because I think this is a rational way to look at this. When you have different comings of the Lord, the Old Testament is all kinds of comings of the Lord, whether Egypt, Assyria, Persia, Israel. New Testament, similar, not as much, but, you know, usually it's just referring to the fall of the physical kingdom of Israel in the first century, or he's talking about the final day of judgment. But when we talk about the final day of judgment, context that we know for a fact, we know for sure, are talking about the final coming of the Lord. There is no prophecy that there was going to be a great falling away before that. And 2 Thessalonians, you know, he's telling them about a coming of the Lord where first there must be a great falling away, and then there must be the appearing of the man of lawlessness. But in contexts that we know for sure are dealing with the final coming, we don't hear anything about a great falling away as a prerequisite before the final day of judgment, the end of the world. Also, in those contexts, there is never a mention about a single individual who is going to be kind of signaling the approach of the final coming. Everything that I've read in the New Testament about the final coming is that we have nothing to signal that approach. We have no sign. We have nothing where we can look around and say, okay, yeah, you know, in the next couple years, it's going to happen. You know, according to the New Testament, we don't have it. Now, false doctrine nowadays, we hear a lot about that, those kinds of things. But as far as the biblical record, it doesn't say anything about that. Now, when it comes to Christ and his reference to becoming there in the first century, his coming in judgment, it wasn't a physical coming, all right? It was a spiritual coming, just like he had done, God had ruled and did all throughout the Old Testament text, coming in judgment against Egypt and Assyria, Babylon, on and on and on. Here, the same language is used in the New Testament to refer to his coming against Israel, his coming against those who had rejected him, those who had pierced him and had put him up on the cross. And in those contexts, we do hear about a great falling away. Matthew 24, when Jesus is talking about these things, he says to his apostles, many will fall away. And that's really what our focus was last week. And then what is also interesting in contexts that are dealing with that first century judgment against Israel is that there is a discussion in these various contexts about one man who is incredibly blasphemous, one man who is a terrible, terrible individual, a very godless individual, and he will be approaching, and it seems like he has something to do with the fall of the house of Israel in the first century. So with all of that, you know, taken into account, I would suggest that 2 Thessalonians and the discussion of the man of lawlessness coming before the coming of the Lord is not referring to something that we need to be concerned about in our lifetime or in the future. All right? I do not think that we should be looking for this man of lawlessness in our nation or any other nation or something to come in the future. I think this was something that had to do with those people and in those days. And I think some of the immediate context of 2 Thessalonians 2 helps us with that, although we're not going to be able to really dig into 2 Thessalonians 2 this time. What I want to focus on is what we didn't have time to do last time, and that is talk about other contexts that refer to one particular blasphemous man. And so we're going to do that today. Now, one of the scriptures that we did look at, I want to point out a few other things about it, was 1 John 2 and verse 18. Now, here John, writing to the church in the first century, to Christians in the first century, he says, little children, okay? Now, in the Greek, literally, it says, little boys and girls. And I love that. I don't know, I just love that. Little boys and girls. He says, it is the last hour. And you have heard that the Antichrist is coming. Even now many Antichrists have come, by which we know that it is the last hour. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out, that they might be made manifest that none of them were of us. Now, here he is talking about something that was going on in their time, by which he is saying it is the last hour. All right? So he's definitely pointing to a context that is with reference to things going on in that generation, the coming of the Lord against those who were anti-Christs. All right? Those who had rejected Christ. Of course, the house of Israel is greatly included with all of this. And some of those who had become Christians, and we know that how much the Hebrews, what a hard time they had remaining faithful, right? That's what the whole book of Hebrews is written, because of the great difficulty that they had remaining faithful. They were drifting away. And John is talking about these individuals who were once in the church, and he says, they went out from us. And he calls them antichrists. Now, in the Greek, that's plural, antichrist. And in English, that it's shown as plural as well. Now, up here, he does say it is the last hour, and as you have heard, that the antichrist is coming. Now, up here on the board, I'm using the New King James, even though I have the ESV up front here on the pulpit. But the New King James says the antichrist. And I really appreciate that. That's why I have it up on the board. Now, some of the translations, like the ESV, would just say, you have heard that Antichrist is coming. Which sounds a little bit odd, you know, for me reading that or saying that. And it doesn't ring too well with me. But when you look back at, say, your, you know, interlinear Greek to English Bibles or something like that, where you can see the Greek there with the English. And what you see here in this text is that there is the definite article present in the Greek. The Antichrist, all right? That definite article, the, which we use all the time in English, but the Greeks didn't use it very much. The Greeks only used the definite article when they really needed to use the definite article. And so when the definite article is used, I always believe that it's got to be in there. It has to be shown in the English text because it's important. That definite article is important. So here he is saying, you have heard that the Antichrist, definite article, the Antichrist is coming. And so, and what he's pointing out here in verse 19 is these many Antichrists, plural, they left us, okay? This is a falling away. He says, many Antichrists have come. They came out. They were with us, and now they have not continued with us. They've left. What he's pointing out in verse 19 is a great falling away in the church. So in his time, just like there in 2 Thessalonians 2, when Paul's talking about a coming of the Lord, and he says, but that's not going to happen yet, Thessalonians. That's not going to happen until there's the falling away. And it's interesting that Paul uses the definite article there as well. There is the falling away. One particular falling away that's going to happen that the Thessalonians already knew about. That must happen first. And then there must be the man of lawlessness. The man who is lawless. The man who is godless. And here it's interesting that John, he's using different languages. But we see in the different words, he's spelling out the same ideas. There have been many who have left the church. There is this falling away. And now he says, and this is signaling the last hour for us. And, of course, John was a Jew. He was of the house of Israel. So this greatly affected him. And a lot of, you know, all it would have affected all the Christians. It would have affected the whole world. The coming of Christ in the first century against the house of Israel. So, he says, we know it's the last hour because we're seeing these signals happen. See? So, Paul talking about signals, two signals, a falling away and a terrible person. Here, John's talking about two signals. No, he knows now it's the last hour. Well, of course, he's not talking about the final day of judgment here. He can't. Because there's no way he would use the last hour. All right? We don't talk that way when we're referring to things that are going to happen thousands of years in the future. Right? We're 2,000 years removed from 1 John. How could he say it's the last hour? We haven't seen the final coming yet. So certainly that's not what he's talking about. These are rational people. These were regular people like you and I. And when they spoke of things, when they spoke of time, when they said, it's the last hour, or when they said, Jesus is coming soon, or when they said, these things must soon take place, what does that mean? It means the same thing that it means today, in the way we communicate. It means something urgent, something that was going to be happening within a very short amount of time within their lifetime. So here we have the definite article, the Antichrist. And so there is one that they were watching for. There was one that they were waiting for to surface. And when John wrote this epistle, he hadn't surfaced yet. But John's saying, but look at the falling away that's happening. So that means it's about to happen. He's about to appear. So, John is on the same track with Paul there. Now let's take a look at some other things. Some that probably more challenging text. Let's go over to Daniel chapter 7. Now Daniel's in the Old Testament, but Daniel certainly spoke with some interesting details about things that would be happening in the first century, the days in which Christ would take the throne and take the kingdom. And Daniel is all about the coming of the church. He talks about it, you know, it's in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 7, he talks about the same thing, the idea of the coming of the church and the establishment of the kingdom under Christ that would happen under the fourth beast, all right? He talks about these beasts as these great Gentile nations. And it's not too difficult as we read through. We don't have time to read through all of this. And we've spent some time in Daniel 7 and other times as well. And we can spend more time on it later, too, if we want to. But it's not too challenging to read through the text and to see that the first beast that Daniel's talking about can be really, you know, the text itself shows us that that is referring to the Babylonian kingdom. First beast being the Babylonian kingdom. So the second beast being Persia. The next beast to come after would be the Greeks, the Macedonian Empire. And then the fourth beast would be the Romans. There's a lot of things in Daniel that really help solidify those, you know, that kind of labeling of the beasts. But these things we've talked about in times past. That's why I'm not trying to deal with it too much right now. So in Daniel 7, he's talking about this this vision here of this fourth beast. And this fourth beast that arises on the earth, this is Rome. And in verse 23, it says, "Thus he said," this is the angel talking to Daniel, he said, "As for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, ten kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones, and shall put down three kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand for times, times, and half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him." So Daniel, you see, especially from the end of that record, he is talking about the coming of Christ's kingdom, the coming of the days in which Christ will say, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. He rules over all nations with a rod of iron." Now, it's within this time. So we see this idea of the Roman Empire has arrived at the scene. They haven't gone through the entirety of their history. He says there's going to be 10 kings. Okay? So Daniel's not interested in the entire history of Rome. He's not interested in the fall of the Western Empire in 476 AD. That's way too far into the future for what he's dealing with. He is interested in the first century. And if we would just take the 10 horns of Rome, we'd see that that puts us right in the perfect spot of the situation there of the first century. If you look at the 10 kings of the empire, you start with Julius. I know a lot of people don't want to start with Julius. I think the reason why they don't want to start with Julius is because it doesn't fall in line with their particular own ideas of the book of Daniel or the book of Revelation. You have to include Julius Caesar. And the reason why I say that is not because adding Julius falls in line with my way of thinking, but because, in fact, I've changed my way of thinking. I didn't used to count Julius, and I realized that's not right. Because when I look at the first century history, when you look at Tacitus, you look especially Suetonius. Okay, these are Roman historians who lived in the first century. Who do they always begin with? When they are counting the emperors, who do they always begin with? Julius. Suetonius wrote, in the days of the first century, he wrote the lives of the 12 Caesars. 12 Caesars. He started with number 1, Julius, and he ended with number 12, Domitian. All right? These are guys in the first century. This tells me that the first century mind viewed Julius as the first. They counted him as number 1. And so I know that we are far from the first century, and I know that this is not what your college professor will say about the history of the Roman Empire. All right? They will start with Augustus as the beginnings of the empire. But Daniel, the book of Revelation, these things weren't written to the college professors of the 21st century. They're written to how people thought in the first century. And so that can pose a challenge to us. But as I said, the first century writers view Julius as the first. So if you look at the first 10 horns of the empire, you have Julius, and then Augustus, then Tiberius, then Caligula, then Claudius, then Nero, then Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian, the 10. And then he describes another horn that it starts to surface. This would be the 11th. Now, he's not included with the 10, all right? He's not his own horn yet. He's a little horn that has sprouted. So this tells us that the situation that Daniel is referring to of this judgment, this coming of Christ and His kingdom and all of this, that it would be happening in the days of the 10th horn, which the angel says are the kings. The 10th king, I remember the Jews, they didn't call them emperors, did they? They called them kings. So it'll be happening in the 10th king with an 11th who is, well, he's a horn all right, but he's not a reigning horn, not exactly. And so that's why he is included. But the picture of this illustration, this big beast illustration, that's obviously growing and it continues to grow. You know, it continues to have more and more horns along the way. We have now up to the point of 10 horns at the scene of what is happening in the prophecy of Daniel. 10 horns, Vespasian would be the king at the time, with this 11th horn that's sprouting up. He's not a full-blown king. He's going to be. He's going to grow to be that one day. But in the situation of Daniel 7, he is not his own full-blown king yet. But he is this little horn. And notice that he is very pompous. He is very blasphemous. In verse 25, it says, "He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hands for time, times, and half a time." So, and also he said that three fell before him. three fall before him. Now, Vespasian and his son Titus. Titus will be the 11th in time. But Vespasian and Titus, they both receive the title Caesar at the same time. All right? They're both essentially anointed and declared emperor at the same time, even though it's really Vespasian who would continue for some time before Titus takes over at his death. There is this 11th that is showing up here in the text. And the focus is on this one man, this 11th horn of this great beast, this beast that is Rome. And so you have, Titus, if you just do the count, it's Titus is number 11. If you drop out Julius and you start with Augustus, number 11 would be Domitian. But as I said, I think it is wild, even though I used to believe it myself, I think it's wild for us to say that Domitian is number 11 when we have someone who lived in the first century who wrote the lives of the 12 Caesars, and Domitian is 12, not 11. So Domitian can't be the little horn. Furthermore, we have no record in history that Domitian ever did anything wrong to a Christian. You'll only find that in commentaries on the book of Revelation. You won't find that in history. So it's important to stick to the historical record here. If we're just doing the simple count, we're finding that we fall at number 11. We find that we fall with Titus, and he is this, he's supposed to be in prophecy, this very pompous individual that's going to change a lot of things up, and he's going to be a very godless person, and he's also going to seek to persecute the church. So we're going to have to see if that's accurate, if that would be an accurate description of this man. Let's go over to Revelation chapter 13 and consider a few things there. Revelation chapter 13, we come to the first century. Revelation 1:1 says what? These things must soon take place. The end of Revelation chapter 22, verse 6 says these things must soon take place. Jesus says, I'm coming soon. The text says the time is near. All right, we have an immediacy. In fact, the end of the book says if you are a godly person, stay godly. If you are a sinner, I'm sorry, you're out of time. That is how quickly this book would be transpiring. The events of these prophecy would be happening. It would be immediate. It would be soon, as the text says. It would be near, as the text says. And so the whole result of the book should be unfolding within the next 2 years, if you will, or so, of the situations. Now, we're in the first century talking about things that would be happening in the first century. And we have a beast. Just like Daniel talked about a beast. We have a beast. Now, he's described quite a bit differently here, but the same blasphemous, pompous kind of individual. In Revelation 13, verse 5, the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. Right? Which, that's the same, that's 3.5 years. That's time times and half a time, just like Daniel. Daniel said time, that's the same thing. 42 months. It opened his mouth, verse 6, it opened his mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling that is those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. This is almost identical, almost word for word from Daniel chapter 7. You have this pompous, blasphemous beast, right? And he's persecuting for times and a half a time, or 42 months, 3.5 years, persecuting. He's making war with the saints. This is all the exact same theme. And then you get to verse 18, the last verse of chapter 13. It says, "This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man." His number is 666. I'm not going to explain that. not now anyway, but I don't have time for that. But I do want to say the reason why I'm pointing this out, not to try to confuse us anymore, but to try to hone in our vision of all of this. Let's focus not on the number 666. Don't worry about that right now. Worry about the fact that it says that this is the number of a man. It's the number of a man. And this is what we're getting at. When you look at these scriptures like 2 Thessalonians 2, Daniel 7, Revelation 13, Revelation 17, all of these scriptures, they all seem to be referring to this exact same idea of one singled out blasphemous man who persecutes and destroys, and he's a terrible person. And so here we get to the number of the beast, and he says specifically, this is the number of a man. And so a man here is being singled out. And we get to chapter 17 of the book of Revelation, and that's exactly what we see, is a man being singled out as a man of lawlessness and a son of perdition. In chapter 17 and verse 3, John says, "And he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. So again, John is seeing this a beast. And guess what? It's full of blasphemous names. Right? Same idea, same theme. Now the beast looks quite a bit different. And again, that's because it's a picture. All right? If it was a literal beast, it would probably have to look the same all the time, right? But Daniel uses this beast picture to focus on certain things, and he does that. You get to Revelation, he uses the beast picture, but, you know, the drawing of the beast is different, somewhat different. But that's because Revelation is trying to focus on other details. So really the only idea that really remains the same is the fact that this is a beast. Okay, this is a big bully, you know, who is destructive. Beasts being in God's word always being Gentile nations, right? Even old Egypt was talked about as a great sea monster, okay? Old Egypt was called Rahab, the great Leviathan, you know, these great sea monsters. But you get to Book of Revelation, you see another monster, you know, and this isn't just you know, some big zoo animal. This is, as chapter 13 pointed out, this beast came out of the sea with 7 heads and 10 horns. This is an enormous sea monster. Once again, we have another Leviathan. Just like Egypt was called that great Leviathan, the monster in the sea. Here we have the monster in the sea. Because what do we have but the difference between sea and land in the Bible, in the book of Revelation? Land That's the land of Israel, right? The sea is everything beyond the land of Israel. The Gentiles, Egypt, you know, Rome, all of that. These are Gentile lands, and they're Gentile, they're sea beasts, all right? So, same idea here. And this beast, full of blasphemous names. So we see that that theme carries all the way through the biblical record. You get to verse 11, and this is where the angel stops John and says, look, I know, I can tell you're incredibly amazed by all of this. Your jaw has dropped. I'm going to help you understand what this is. And so this is when he actually gets a bit literal here with what he is talking about. And so he says in verse 11, as for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven and it goes to destruction. See, actually, let me read over in verse 10. He said, they are also seven kings. So these seven heads of this beast are seven kings. Now, in Daniel 7, we talked about 10 kings, but Daniel said that three fell before the 11th, right? Or at least before the 10th and 11th, because the 10th and 11th became emperor at the same time. So three fell. So if you have 10 and you minus three, that's seven. So Daniel is painting a much broader picture, but Revelation just says seven. But it's all amounting to the same thing. And so here you have this, these seven heads of the beast. And he says that there are seven kings in verse 10. He says, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other is not yet come. When he comes, he must remain only a little while. And so going back to the list of kings up here on the board, when you have five of them having fallen, that would be Julius, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, and Claudius, these emperors of Rome. And then he says one is, which would be Nero. This would be somewhere around the very end of Nero's life. And then he says the other has not yet come. When he comes, he'll continue just a short while before what the book's really getting at is going to happen. Not that this man's going to die after a short while, but the event that we're really looking forward to, okay, the fall of the great harlot city in the text, We're waiting for that. That's going to happen shortly after the seventh assumes the throne. That's Vespasian, all right? So, and again, this is, you know, AD 69. This was just a few, you know, short months before the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. So, Vespasian. And then he says in verse 11, as for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven. It goes to destruction. It is the son of perdition. And that's what we're getting at in 2 Thessalonians 2, is Paul's talking about this man of lawlessness that he calls a son of perdition. And here we have a man singled out in Revelation, things in the first century. Who is this person going to perdition, like Paul was talking about? So he says, there's seven heads on this beast, but there is an eighth as well. In fact, the eighth is this beast. And so he's not reigning at the time. In fact, but he points out that he's an eighth. All right, he says he's of the seven. Okay, he's of the kings. But we see how the illustration describes the eighth differently than the seven. Just like in the book of Daniel, you had all these established horns that were kings, the angel said. And then you had this little one popping up. You know, he's not the reigning king, but he's the one that's causing the issues. In Revelation, it's the same idea. We have seven heads. We're up to, in prophecy now, the seventh king, Vespasian. But you have the eighth. He says, he's of the seven. You know, he is Caesar. He's not reigning at the time. And he's the one causing the problem. Isn't that interesting? So the one who's not the reigning king is causing the issue. is the son of perdition. So however you look at it, whether from Daniel, where he says that three fell before, you know, that'd be the three that fell in the year of the four empires before Vespasian and Titus assumed the throne. Or whether you're looking at the book of Revelation, all of them seem to be pointing to one person. They seem, to me, it seems like they're pointing to this man named Titus. And Paul in 2 Thessalonians, as I said, he's pointing out this man of lawlessness that was coming. John, in his first epistle, was pointing out the Antichrist, definite article, the Antichrist that was coming. And so all these scriptures are all talking about one person. They all seem to be talking about the same person. Okay, the descriptions are all about identical, wherever you look. So, if this is accurate, that we're dealing with possibly Titus as the son of perdition, the man of lawlessness, then we will need to investigate that a little bit further and see if history deals with this man in that kind of light. We don't have time to do that, obviously, tonight. So we'll have to revisit that next time around. So I appreciate your consideration of this study. I know I went kind of quickly. I know some of these things are pretty difficult. So if you have any thoughts or questions, I'd be glad to hear them. We'd like to extend the gospel's invitation tonight to anyone who's yet to come unto the Lord, the way He has called us in truth of the gospel. If you have faith in Him, that you confess Him as your Savior, repent of your sins, and be baptized for the remission of your sins, if that describes your need tonight, then please come forward and let us know. All together we stand and sing.